I need to do some theological, some heavy theological lifting in some places. So I'm going to ask you to be patient. I have a script that I'm working from, but I have purposefully put in place some places of cognitive rest where we're going to have a time to interact. And I know you need that because I want to help you process that. And so I just want to kind of help you just get familiar with where I'm headed. I think it'll be helpful. The title of my talk is Who is Afraid of Sports? Play, Bodies, and Formation. The question of how to relate theological convictions to the lived experience of sports can be a mystery that many Christians in the church do not always get an opportunity to contemplate constructively. Sports are one of the most important cultural phenomena of our time. Think about it. Sports touch all dimensions of human life and intersect virtually every social institution, including family, school, business, community, government, and religion. Unfortunately, the dialectical relationship between sports and Christianity has historically been misunderstood, syncretized, minimized, or ignored among some religious traditions and theological circles. That's why I'm excited for the topic this year by a Presbyterian seminary. For many clergy and church communities today, sports are feared or distrusted and even identified as chief concern and culprit for declining church attendance. So there's a study that came out in 2014 by a Canadian sociologist, Steve McMullen, and he surveyed 16 different churches, some of them mainline congregations in North America, Canada, and the United States, as well as some conservative. And he got different reactions as far as how do you account for the declining church attendance? And a number of them said it was because of sports. But perhaps the task in theology in the Christian life might reframe rather than belittle, instrumentalize, reject, or fear the power and popularity of sports. So here's the question that I'm attempting to answer. What would it look like to inhabit this contested sphere of life with our theological eyes wide open? Since sports surround us as an aspect of popular culture, in the particular context of our world, we should try to understand and even investigate its theological significance. So I'm going to do some heavy lifting here for a little bit, and then at the end, in addition to the points of interaction, I'm going to ask the so what question. What's the cash value of this, so to speak? Before I delve into the theological significance of sport as play, I need to cover some preliminary groundwork on the nature of sport, specifically regarding the family resemblances we observe when identifying the activities we commonly call sports. I find this helpful, for it explains our attraction to sports on a deeper level of identity. So, for those who have been schooled in dogmatics doctrine, a theological anthropology I'm giving here at first. And it opens us up to see how the ubiquity of this lived experience indiscriminately cuts across age, sex, gender, class, race, orientation, culture, and religion. So I'm going to give you some rough and ready descriptions here, and then I think it'll help set up where I want to go. So a couple things to keep in mind as we talk about sports, right? It is a phenomenon, but it's a lived experience. And as you get people's testimonies, as you get thick descriptions, as you begin to hear both from insiders and outsiders, there's a number of characteristics that do a good job of explaining what sports is. First, sports as play is a voluntary, free activity. Humans willingly engage in playful activities. They freely accept the limits, boundaries, and constraints imposed by them in this make-believe world when entering their games and sports. So that's pretty simple and straightforward. Secondly, sports are regulated and limited by rules. They have structure. This is what's beautiful about them, right? We step out of ordinary life into a mutually agreed upon, defined, visible, set apart, ordered sphere or space, and it's in the lines on a rugby field, or fairways or greens on a golf course, and we do this in order to make sport possible. There's a design to every sport. It is what it is, right? Because there's a constitutive rules, like the dimensions, the duration of a game, the equipment and material, which is allowed or not allowed. And there's also norms, prescriptive norms, as well as proscriptive rules. There's spitballs in baseball are illegal. Drafting in triathlons, I was a triathlete, are illegal. The norms limit the approved means of goal attainment and prohibit more efficient means in favor of less efficient means. So right away when you start thinking about this, because sport is set apart from ordinary life, oftentimes theologians start to look at this and go, there's something happening here that's apart from clock time, chronos, maybe even on a kairos level. Perhaps, we'll talk about that. Although the structure given to our sports remind us that there is a formal logic to differentiate one sport from another, football's not basketball, however, sports do occur in temporal contexts, supported and organized by institutions to varying degrees. That means there is a double character to sport. And this is important, or we can become very romantic and idealistic about sports. There's a formal logic plus the wider network of cultures, traditions, and institutions in which they are embedded. Now, the latter is what Dr. Marcia Shute presciently and prophetically calls out and attends to in her research, and I welcome that very much. Because of these wider networks or contexts, aspects like economic interests, power, and political concerns, and various ideologies can and do chafe and bump up against the formal elements of sport. And if we're not vigilant as the people of God about the nature of sports, then not only is the logic of sport, those characteristics, at risk, but how we play and organize sports can and does mute and silence the voices of the players themselves who need the church's advocacy for justice in order to recover what is really true, good, and beautiful about sports. Okay, take a minute to observe this. I hope you're overwhelmed by it. That's my intention. Someone's language or metaphors, there's a sense of distress. The deeper you go into sports, there's a dizzying effect. The most conclusive research that I'm aware of as far as looking at the moral formation of athletes is done by a host of female scholars out of University of Idaho, Sharon Stoll. And she studied over 72,000 athletes over 18 years in high school and college. And she, her control group were non-athletes, duh, right? So as she looked at this, she was trying to see, let's discern their ability to decide right from wrong, their moral reasoning skills. Because we use these anecdotes all the time. Sports builds character. Really? According to her research, not necessarily. The operative word will be today is can. It can. But there's no necessary entailment. If we play sports, kind of an if-then modus ponens, right? If we play sport, then we build character. Not necessarily. And what she found is some disturbing conclusions. One, the longer you play sports and the higher the level of competition, the more morally calloused you become. Male sports, or men, worse than women. Team sports worse than individual sports. That's disturbing evidence. And I think as a church, this is an opportunity for us to help people to actually begin to negotiate and navigate this slice of life in a way that helps people to intelligently understand sports so that sports, as Marcia's pointed out, can be a place of human flourishing, of vitality. So this slide is one that I've adapted from conflict and critical theorists when attempting to dialogue with and interpret culture in general, phenomena such as film and sports in particular. So I teach a really fun course. This is what's fun about creating a kind of a new field of inquiry. I teach this course on sports literature and film. And we read some of the classic sports literature as well as some of the best sports films because they're pregnant with theological themes. And how should we pastorally and ecclesiologically respond to these issues? And so I've adapted this. You'll never find it in a book, but it's kind of a hodgepodge of what other people have done. Sport is a cultural jig, using a guy named Matthew Crawford's language, with a vast array of assumptions, worldviews are at work here, institutions, governing bodies, corporate sponsors, families, viewers, media, habits, judgments, and practices, all of which can constrain, trigger, help, and even hinder our actions towards some guiding purpose. I want my audiences to know when I use this is how to read sports as a cultural discourse. So I'm offering you really kind of one-on-one on a cultural hermeneutic driven by our theological presuppositions. And that what is going on in sports is a very complex dynamic interaction between these different poles. Because those different poles have different interests. They have different teleoi, right? Different purposes, different goals. And it's putting this whole phenomenon, when you step into it, under a lot of pressure to deliver. That means the why, the what, and how of sports depends largely on context and perspectives. No brainer here, sports is not done in a vacuum. I tell youth ministers, if your youth are involved in sports, this activity is a kind of cultural discipleship that forms them in ways, good and bad, that most fail to fathom how deep sports indexes the multiple dimensions of their humanity. I mean, it can be a rich place or it can be a distorted place that actually retards human flourishing. So let's begin to think through this. You step into this, and you begin to think about the human body, right? So if you're a proprietor, what are some takes that you would have on the human body in sports? What would be your valuing, your meaning attached and given to the bodies that are colliding, the bodies that are excelling in the game of sports? What might be some perspectives that they would bring to the table? Okay, good. So as you begin to think about the human body, it's at the disposal or service of the almighty dollar. I kind of like Karl Marx. There's a few things he got really right. Follow the money, right? The money's telling us a lot. That's a value, right? If you say you're a giving Christian, well, we really wanted to get honest. Let's open up our checkbook and let's look. That's the value, right? So there's value placed in that. How about from the viewers? As you think about the human body, what do they value about the human body, the viewers? Okay, so sitius, altius, fortius, swifter, stronger, higher, right? That's been an ancient motto. What's the other one? Yeah, they want a good game, right? So there's an attraction there. So they want bodies that are, that are muscled, well-oiled, that are toned, right? They want an entertainment aspect of it, however those bodies deliver that. Okay, let's just keep going around. How about gender construction and identity? When I was in fifth or sixth grade, my dad was trying to figure out, why isn't my son playing football? Why isn't he starting? And he went and talked to the coach, who was a good friend of his, and here's what the coach told my father. I've been in counseling ever since. Your son is not mean enough. I remember my dad coming back, okay, now I'm fifth grade. I can't cognitively, morally get my head around that one. But as years have expired, I begin to think about, wait a minute, what is that saying about what it means to be a human being? What is that saying about what it means to be a man? I migrated to other sports because I'm thinking, again, I'm not saying this is all on football. I'm just saying that there's that myth out there, that language that David talked about in his sermon that is actually informing the way I understand my identity. I went to swimming, cycling. I guess you don't have to be mean in those sports. Okay, so let's think about gender identity here. How is it being constructed? What are some of the ideologies? What are some of the habits and judgments that are being made by coaches with respect to gender identity? It's meant to be a wide open question. So this isn't like see Spot ran who ran. I'm afraid to ask. I don't know. Spot, you know. So it's wide open. Yeah, so this language, and I'm going to talk more about this today, tomorrow. I have a new book that just came out, and I would have told the folks here about it. It just came out. It's on sports and violence. And so one of the things I begin to examine is that when we think about how these perverse ideas get into sports, right, they become habituated gestures. Without sports, weekends would be weekdays. So let's begin to think about getting behind the text, the world actually of the text, and even think about the world in front of the text. We'll leave interpret it yet. Let's just leave this, whatever it is on the right here, towards the end. So what is the message, right? If it's a cultural discourse, sports is proposing, promising, it's pitching things to us. What is the message here? Let's set it up this way. Very good, Susan. If sports did not exist, or in the absence of sports, then weekends would be reduced to weekdays. The meaning? This is where it's important. This isn't an ad in Canada. Wouldn't work. This isn't an ad in different parts of Africa, right, in Asia, right? And now more and more because of the globalization, the influence of the West and America, this will start to work, unfortunately. But the meaning is here, well, in the U.S., we live and work for the weekends. And if sport did not exist, then in reality, we would have nothing to live for. Ooh, my students, oh, Dr. White, you're just too critical. I say, maybe ESPN is tongue-in-cheek. I don't think so. ESPN wants this to be true. They need this to be true. Who owns ESPN? Disney, right? They want this to be true. Now let's go to this right here. Okay, that's not meant to be a slam on Disney or anything, but there is a relationship there. So sports is good for something, and in this ad, sports is good for entertainment, for a break. Redefining leisure, right? That sports is going to be the primary place. It's the canons of sport will define leisure. So go back to the critical circle. Let's step into this now with this paradigm that I'm proposing to you. And let's think about the implications with respect to the media. What habits, judgments, and practices would reinforce such an ideology in the world of sports with ads such as this? So it's the commercialization, right, that proliferates through sports. They want it for entertainment value. So what's going to happen in the world of the game? What kind of things might they even begin to change in sports in order to make it more entertaining? Rules, right? You would think the rules are for human welfare, and sometimes they are, but if I really want to get nasty in my interpretation, I'd say, well, that's just because these folks are commodities, and you need them to stay in the game longer, right? But rules could change. We want to make it more novel, more interesting, shot clock, things like that, because that's going to make it sexier, that's going to make it more titillating, right? All these things that, whoa, this is exciting, and it would get people to come there. Sports rules are often changed, not for the good of the sports persons, but for the benefit and the welfare of the proprietors of the game. So pretty straightforward there. And let's go back to the symbolic capital of this image. First, just make some observations. Please, you know, it's kind of like basic interpretation skills. My students immediately want to interpret. Let's just identify things. What do you see before you start interpreting? Okay, good. So it's an individual. Think about, remember, if you ever, it's a child. That's very good. How about what color is a child? Okay, good. How about the clothing? Yeah, good. White shorts. What do you think the white shorts symbolize? Along with his childhood. Purity, innocence. What might that mean fused with this message? And soccer. When you think about the growth of American soccer, right, it has a certain donor, a certain participant that oftentimes excludes other people because of cost and the traveling and all those things that are involved with it. And so all these things are being pressed. When someone steps into sports, we have to recognize, we have to have our head on, our eyes wide open, because we may be entertaining, our loyalties and affections may be blinding us and having us see and hear things that aren't really healthy. This diagram also illustrates that any question we might raise about one area or pole is embedded in a situation so complex that every answer begets another layer of complications. You've heard the phrase, wicked questions, wicked problems. Social planners talk about this, and what they're getting at here is that our attraction to sports is both fascinating and maddening, because as soon as you think you have addressed and resolved a problem, the whole drama can shift and take on a new form, whether at recreational, club, collegiate, Olympic, or professional level. Let's go back to our elements. Physicality of sports, and this is what I'm going to focus on tomorrow, the human body in sports. This refers to the fact that this embodied performance entails training, kinesthetics, right? Bodies in motions, agile, coordination, their skills, prowess, all of which aim toward demonstrating physical excellence. It is sensual. In fact, it's interesting, a study as far as the history of the human body of sports, it's very erotic. I mean, this is sensual. This is all the senses full on when you're in sports, and it's strenuous in nature, with a premium placed on the exertion of bodies, role-playing, and improvisation. It is a competitive goal, determined activity. We strive with and against others in order to achieve particular goals through the use of various strategies and means. And when you think about it, this only makes sense when you step into the logic of sports. Basketball, the goal is to get the ball in the hoop. I'm from Indiana, so I know that. There are way more efficient ways to do that. I'm going to run with it. No. You can't run with it. There's rules. And so when you step in, you agree to these rules, and it's going to make it more difficult, more inefficient, because there's something about a problem-solving element that makes sports so attractive. and that it doesn't just involve me trying to figure it out. There's even a deeper kind of play that I'm doing it with another person. So there's a sociality dimension to sports as we strive for these goals. Lastly, the one we sometimes forget about, unpredictability. The outcomes are uncertain, even though modern sports does its darndest to overcome this. This is one that modern sports does not like. Just examine sports science, sports pedagogy, for they often try to eliminate, manipulate, or minimize unpredictability with their hyper-rational, controlling strategies, technologies, and training methods, along with their fixation on quantification seen in the precise timing and measurements, in-helmet headsets, titanium golf clubs, composite tennis rackets, sleek LZR swimsuits, wish they had those when I was a swimmer, Tommy John surgery, even on adolescents, instant replay, altitude tents. However, this is what's fun because you can't completely control this. The unpredictability often wiggles from these attempts to strangle sport, and with episodes and games where luck and chance prevail, players slipping and falling, changes in weather and wind, which derail even the best laid plans and scripts. And I especially love that when it's my team that wins. The autotelic nature of sports. And this is where I'm going to spend the rest of my time, is on this aspect. Sport is a species of play. It's a variety of play, which an important part of play is that is autotelic. Just break it down. Auto means own, telos means goal. Its purpose is internal to it, which means we are engaged in it for its own sake. Don't go looking around for reasons outside of play in order to understand it, since it has its own reasons, goods, and goals. When compared to other activities such as work, play is non-purposeful. For nothing is produced, though there is meaning discovered within the game itself. As we get caught up in our play, attitudinally and effectively, we experience a plethora of goods teeming in sports such as joy, pleasure, release, fun, and on, for these supervene on or attached to what we love about our games and sports. The why, aim, or what for play is play itself, period. And thus, the best-kept secret of play, and what needs to be left alone, is that the love of play centers on what is trivial, not its benefits. Now hang on that metaphor, because I'm going to play with it theologically. An attractive feature to this play element is that players are temporarily carried away from the quotidian demands of life, such as excretion, eating, drinking, reproducing, and sleeping, to what is unnecessary. All the vital activities, which were the former, are directed towards the preservation of humanity and thus meeting our needs. Play is not in that category of cultural activities. One scholar says, play has a new time, a play time, a new space, a playground, which function as parentheses in the life of and world of the player. So I did my dissertation at University of Edinburgh, and I primarily worked with three interlocutors were Augustine, John Paul II, Carol Wojtyla, and then Bonhoeffer. And so I've done a lot of work. Some of the best work has been done by Catholic philosophers and theologians in sports. And here's one of them, Michael Novak, who just died recently. Play is the most human activity. It is the first act of freedom. It is the first origin of law. Watch even an infant at play, whose first act is marking out the limits, the rules, and the roles. Play is not tied to necessity. It is to enjoy something that is not practical or productive or required for gaining food or shelter. This unnecessary or trivial aspect of play correlates with our own creaturely identity. According to the Christian doctrine of creation, as revealed in Act 1 of the Bible storyline, God alone is the playful subject and artisan of everything that exists. Without God, nothing. The work of creation was not necessary, neither logically nor metaphysically, nor was it morally obligatory. So Bonhoeffer, who I work with, says this, and he clarifies that what stands between God and creaturely reality is simply nothing. He states, for freedom is exercised in and on the basis of this nothing. No kind of necessity that could or indeed had to ensue in creation can therefore be demonstrated to exist in God. There is simply nothing that provides the ground for creation. Creation comes out of this nothing. So where does this lead us as far as the doctrine of creation? Nothing inwardly impelled nor externally compelled God to create, but it was completely voluntary and radically free. hint, hint, a kind of play, as an act of unconstrained love. The only thing necessary is the triune God, who in advance of creation is a loving community of persons, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and who is eternally complete, and thus in the beginning there was nothing except God to playfully and freely make heaven and earth. Jürgen Moltmann says it this way: when he, God, creates something that is not God, but also not nothing, then this must have its ground not in itself, but in God's good will or pleasure. Here's the catcher. Hence, God's act of bringing humans into existence means we are really creaturely and not some divine part or extension of God. We have our own integral reality, independent of God, though meaningfully suspended from and graced by God, in whom we live, move, and have our being. God sustains us and gives us our own space, so to speak, to be and to exist for our own sakes. Okay, so I've done some theological lifting here, some pretty heavy lifting. What does this mean practically when moving from sports as play to who we are as humans? Here's the relationship. The phenomenon of play as a practice informs and invites us to know in our participation that on a deeper level, our existence is trivial and gratuitous. And I hope this is a little bit arresting to you, because perhaps you haven't framed it this way. Keep in mind, when I say sport as play is trivial, I do not mean it is unreal, unimportant, meaningless, or lacks a serious internal purpose, nor do I intend to imply that this is for the immature. Rather, trivial means when compared to ordinary life, human pain and suffering, technological progress, political leadership, and daily work, sport as play is relatively, not absolutely, relatively pointless or useless. Likewise, when you compare your creaturely existence to God's existence, you, me, we are not needed. Our existence is like play in that humans are intrinsically valued but useless, for our human reality is not necessary, and therefore our meaning is not found in whether we are useful. In a very real sense, Rowan Williams, who interacts with Karl Barth here, says this: the self before God is not serious. It is groundless. It is not something that exists in its own density and solidity. Therefore, we do not possess our own existence by any right or might. And in fact, the doctrine of redemption is in continuity with this when relating who we are with respect to the Christ event. The death of Christ tells me I'm not serious. Barth sees that what comes from the seriousness of Christ's death is the miracle of the unbearable lightness of being. I like the metaphor he used here. That is to say, the recognition that your reality rests like a feather on the breath of God. An immediate implication is that when we play, we engage in self-affirmation or renewal of the sense of our own contingent, feather-like identity. One philosopher says it this way: what I learn from sports is respect for authenticity, individuality, each player learning his own true instincts, capacities, and style. John Paul II regularly fused creation with his understanding of athletics. Theologically, to play is to express who we are created by God. Here's what John Paul II, you know, he wrote over 200 homilies on sports. And this guy had two PhDs, one in philosophy, one in theology. How many people are writing that much on sports? Now, granted, many of them are short homilies, but nonetheless, he was thinking about these things because he was an insider. He came out of sports. John Paul asserts that athletic activity can help every man or woman to recall that moment when God the Creator gave origin to the human person, the masterpiece of his creative work. Another theologian adds to this: he sees, or she sees, play as a liturgical celebration of our contingency. For sport irreducibly embodies our most basic identity as creatures who enjoy a genuine existence on a trajectory out of nothing towards God, end quote. That means sport as a playful practice, at their best, can dramatize our very constitution as creatures. If play is like this, like a liturgy, or I'm going to say a pedagogy, then it performs from and expresses the lightness of our being, my fragility, my temporality, my boundedness, my fickleness, my finitude. For the non-seriousness of play resonates with the non-seriousness or triviality of our own identity. The creator-creation relationship. Just as play is made up, it's added on, it's set apart from ordinary reality, so also is our existence made up by God and exists independently and qualitatively different from who God is. This line will become so important. This is where we get in trouble in sports. This is really the only line that I think ontically we should be drawing when we think about what it means to be human. We have a tendency to draw the lines in creation, right? Some genders are better than others. Some races are better than others. That line is false. But this line cannot be violated when we step into the world of sports. Play is to ordinary life what our existence qua existence is to God's, and it is through kicking, catching, dribbling, swimming, climbing, and swinging a bat that we echo our splendid reality. So this kind of chimes, we play sport, it chimes or reverberates with how God has made us in its best case scenario. Okay. Yeah, so we have God and who he is. He's necessary. We are unnecessary. So even the works of our hands, and particularly in play, right, it's an analog, I'll get to this in a bit, it's an analog to the way that God made us in relation to him. It's splendidly trivial. It's not necessary. My existence, I understand my existence is not necessary when I realize how expendable I am. God's not expendable. I'm expendable. And so as we step into sports, we want to make sure we keep this distinction. Does that help? Okay. Thank you for stopping me. So here's a summary. To put it bluntly, just as God's creation centers on God creating us freely from nothing towards love, similarly, our sports are creaturely improvisations, for they are summoned by creativity and imagination for the love of playing. That is, our love of play's extravagant uselessness is an analog to God's love of our own splendid triviality. Here's someone who's a practitioner of this, and I wanted you to hear her story. It's a thick description. This is Lindsay Wilson, who now writes for ESPN, former Iowa State women's basketball player. So she wrote a story for ESPN back in 2012 in which she offered simple advice for young people as they consider playing at the next level. She comments that when athletes come to her for help on mental skills to gain confidence, master their nerves, or conquer fears, what is often missing is they have forgotten their love of the game. She asks them to remember their childhood during which they played backyard hoops with an older sibling, Saturday morning games at the local community center, or playing with their neighbors. She has them recall how they are drawn to sports because they love the game in the hopes to rekindle their affections and memories for why they play. She avers that what often happens in one's sports biography is that as a person gives herself to the game, she eventually starts to expect something from the game. That is, for sports to give us something concrete, like wins, accolades, and scholarships. She laments that this is where most of us go wrong, for playing sports does not work this way. She says, don't get me wrong, I'm going to read directly from it now. That was my paraphrase. You'll get something from basketball in the long run, something much more important than anything that gets printed in the newspaper. But it might not be this summer or this year. The true benefits of basketball may be in the less tangible. The pride of giving yourself to something. These are goods intrinsic to sports. The joy of working with your teammates on a common goal. Bart Giamatti wrote a great book called Taking Time for Paradise. Bart Giamatti was the Major League Baseball commissioner, president of Yale, and he calls this the camaraderie of competition. The confidence, she continued with Lindsay, the confidence that comes from working hard. When you play for the love of a game, you foster all those benefits, have more fun, and play better. Now, okay, she's not a social scientist. I'm not going to sit up here and argue that you'll play better. However, sports psychologists have measured this. Those who play based on intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation are healthier athletes and oftentimes do play better. So at least we have that weight of evidence on our side. So continuing, an approximate ethical implication is that when the trivial nature of sport is lost, it easily becomes, now listen, pay attention to me, more than a game, which trespasses against the play element of sport, and if play and our creaturely existence do have conceptual overlap, then we take our sports too seriously. When we take our sports too seriously, we have also taken our creaturely existence too seriously, which for Christian theology, we've talked about this already today with Marcia, means we have boosted or elevated, that's Paul Tillich's language, our own existence along with the works of our hands seen in activities like sports to that of something God never intended. This is idolatry, which, like all their improper and disobedient responses to God in reality, is an ethical issue. Idolatry in sport starts when we adopt imaginations and motivations that fail to keep the attitude and spirit of play in perspective, manifest in actions and attitudes such as cheating. Athletes are not playing if they cheat, win at all cost, over serious coaches and parents, or the commodification of athletes. And whenever play goes bad, then something about our own identity goes awry. That means a Christian ethic of sport does not simply encompass moral principles for discerning right from wrong. So not some kind of decisionism, right? What are we supposed to do in this quandary? What are we supposed to do? It's much deeper than that, right? It must be about a whole way of being in the world. Our doings of sport follow from and are intimately related to our created identity, who we are as humans. Okay, so let's take a step back. Now I want to test my hypothesis. So I want to pick an ethical issue, and I want to make sense of it in light of what I'm claiming, try to account for this problem in sports. And so here's the ethical issue. I pick one that may seem so innocuous, but it's easy. It might be seen as a straw man. But it's not a straw man if we really think deeply theologically about it. So here's the case in point, the matter of trash talking. Okay, so notwithstanding the fact that perhaps the best instances, I'm trying to be charitable here for a bit here, the best instances of trash talking or chirping probably come out of the genre of comedy. So it's interesting that people are trying to put that in the game because sports is supposed to be fun. So I want to be careful, especially when I find my white friends making judgments on other races or other groups, right? It's more about that it's different. Be careful. You're making a moral judgment here. That is funny. I think you should laugh at that, right? And so it's more in the genre of comedy or even satire and thus articulates a kind of humor which travels a tightrope between amusing and asinine, between adroit and awful. Okay, so here's my rough and ready definition. The bare definition of trash talking denotes disparaging or boastful language used especially to demoralize or intimidate opponents. I think most of you would agree to that. It is talk that figuratively comes from a bin or dumpster, for it is rubbish, trash. But in the wide world of sports, such language is par for the course, since it ostensibly conceals what would normally be considered abusive language. For its proponents, trash talking is used with style, to inject a little more fun into a game, all in the name of good-natured ribbing and teasing. Trash-talking savvy sports persons claim that in-game skills, they see it as a skill, like trash-talking, require practice and familiarity, both with the game and your opponent, and therefore should not be confused with personal affronts, but used merely in the interest of friendly hate. Interesting juxtaposition. So here's a couple quotes. I purposely did not give you names because it takes a while to even look at the context of these quotes, but I just want you to see a couple of quotes that kind of make it a little thicker for you. Trash talking is a widely accepted practice at all levels of sports. We hear and see it in its embryonic form in youth sports. I saw this regularly with my children, not them as the ones doing it. Then it slowly grows with the help of the sunshine and rain of high school and college sports, reaching its purpose in professional sports where exemplars perfect it. It is held that this is part of competitive activity, whose goal is to determine which athlete or team is most excellent. So this is a part of the game. Games are supposed to be a test between persons and skills. Well, here's another skill that you need to become good at in order to win. For users, it increases the possibility of winning. Technically, trash talking uses psychological strategies in the form of negative comments and verbal digs to abuse, disrupt, and unsettle the mental focus and state of others in order to gain a personal edge for the sake of winning. Although such gamesmanship antics are at times entertaining, I'll be the first to admit that, just listen to the heckling and bantering during March Madness, this whole charade instrumentalizes sport to achieve the desired end of winning by advantaging one player or team's exclusive self-interest in an extrinsic good like winning, while subverting the intrinsic good of the play element, which is beautifully inclusive, or it can be shared by everyone. But trash talking, not necessarily. Trash talking pits the seriousness of winning over against the non-seriousness of play, ripping sport apart through the hurtful discharge of words. Quick aside, in our political climate, chirping is certainly not limited to sports. And it's amazing how the current political climate has transmuted this practice from that of vice to virtue. However, this perversion and spoiling of the play element also brings into question the creaturely identity of other co-contestants in this play world, since trash talking employs language, gestures, and rituals that diminish and reduce the meaning and purpose of other human beings to that of merely a means. Trash talking is a transactional take on sport that interferes with the spirit of play, for it neglects to engage in respect that both play and players have their own self-standing as ends in themselves. So I could have picked a number of different athletes. You may not like Andrew Luck. I'm from Indianapolis, so I had to find someone from Indiana here. So Stanford alumnus and Indianapolis Colt QB Andrew Luck stands as a counterexample, for instead of trash-talking, he is known for complimenting others when they make a good play. ESPN records that his congratulations often confuse and confound other players who do not expect an upbeat attitude. In fact, it actually provokes them, this is right from the article, some players to anger, for in their case, they are used to ulterior motives in which the ends justify the means. They convert the uselessness of games into something useful for their own personal advantage. I believe Luck's actions demonstrate a stance or attitude on play which has him comport himself in a manner that responsibly affirms others and the countless possibilities that lie in wait in the game that everyone's playing. Andrew Luck is not taken captive by an alternative stance like mastery or domination of others. For if so, I think his response would be more inclined to choose negative actions and comments that protect or prove his existence out of fear of being seen as no thing, and thus strike back and alienate others. But rather, I see his delight in others' play because he recognizes their shared grateful, creaturely status. Andrew Luck playfully interacts with others since his uselessness is not personally called into question. He knows his identity. He appears to accept his createdness. And rather than resort to culpable actions that look to make him useful with others as his means, he hospitably welcomes their splendid triviality. One philosopher argues that this conception of our humanity entails a particular stance on play itself, which cuts across all play activities. So this is why we got to keep going back to play as a species, as a sports, one of the main species is play. It holds, for example, for children playing house, for a hike in the wilderness, for a person fishing along a quiet stream, for someone playing guitar, as well as for the standard games usually considered sport. It brings about the well-known experience of immersion, the sense we often have in play of being totally involved in our activity, not abstracted or distanced in any way from what we are doing. Here's my main point. To pay a compliment is to celebrate or praise someone, which for athletes like Luck means the logic and spirit of play so absorbs them that this pretended world of play diminishes their self-importance so that others are truly playmates. Net effect, when athletes adopt this mindset inside the space of this extraordinary world, it can educate their imaginations to forget, if not resist, our dominant culture's excessive emphasis on sports productivity, thereby freeing them to appreciate the play of others as an expression of their own dignity and primordial wonder. If my charitable, and I grant you, I may be way too charitable to Andrew Luck here, is correct, then it challenges us to spectate others' good play, regardless of whether they play on our team, in such a manner that we reckon their existence is already charged, using Hopkins' ideas here, with a God-given grandeur. For if not, we might be tempted to think that others are justified or rendered good and beautiful because of their performative value. We should not be surprised how easy it is for this to happen in sports. Sports as a system trades principally on meritocracy, in which sportspersons rise and fall on their own excellences. Personal success is determined by talent and personal effort, seemingly self-evident on scoreboards. And when someone else's performance in comparison to ours temporarily bests us, which it will if you play sports long enough, insecurity, self-doubt, fear, and anxiety can get lodged into our identity. When this occurs, our inner critic's self-talk can whisper, and kids do this regularly, I'm unworthy and without meaning. Once our minds lead us on this downward spiral, it prepares the way for us to opt for objectionable actions like trash talking. Trash talking becomes a strategy to cope with and offset our dis-ease by bolstering, justifying, or proving our existence. Putting others down becomes our MO, for we desperately want to be necessary. We've just trespassed that line. We want to be necessary. We want to be significant. But that's only reserved for God. However, this violates the creator-creature distinction, which our first parents, Adam and Eve, illustrated with their own suppression of this truth. They wanted to become like God, And when chosen today in sports, it overwrites others' insignificance or unnecessary identity as God's image bearers. So, a big no here. Trash talking attempts to travel across this ontic dividing line that separates all creaturely life from God by thinking we are superior to others and necessary. Moreover, this false trajectory, trash talking uses talk or speech that is not God talk. Think about the creation story. God's talk, Devar and Logos, right, lovingly and freely brought this world into existence out of nothing, and God's communication declared its unnecessary graced existence as very good, which trash talking does the exact opposite. The diabolical feature of trash talking is that it uses pseudo-talk to denigrate or contravene God's final word about us, which is ultimately revealed in Christ, the true image of God. Even though this attempt to invert God's order is patently absurd, it still attempts to unhook or untether us from our creaturely existence from God. And without God, then, if trash talking is correct, this renders us no things. To put it another way, trash talking reverses the order of creation. Instead of agreeing with the truth that the triune God calls us into being, calls created beings into being from what they were not, right? Trash talking sunders good created things from the transcendent source, pushing them back to nothingness. This is a nightmare when you think about it theologically. The reversal of order only serves to heighten the angst, which comes from our separation from God, which intimates the first Adam, not the second Adam. Practical application, what's the import here? I think when we understand our splendid triviality, one of the first thing it does is it de-centers us. That we are not the most important thing. And hence the frivolity and superfluity of play reminds us that our existence is sheer gift, lovingly donated to us by the weight or glory of God's necessary existence. That means, in the grand scheme of things, read on a cosmic, ultimate level, both sports and our creaturely existence do not necessarily matter. As Barth says, we are feathers on the breath of God. So another example. How many are familiar with the story of the University of Michigan team when they were heading to the Big Ten tournament? Let me rehearse a little bit. Perhaps you know about it, right? They're en route to a game when their plane skidded on off the runway and crashed across the street into a ditch and coming to a stop before a row of trees. Aside from some bumps and bruises, nobody was seriously injured in what was a terrifying incident. What I found interesting was how Coach Bayline and other players indicated this near-death scare altered their perspective. That is, playing basketball in comparison to close calls, death, and tragedies is insignificant. Playing basketball is seen as non-serious when juxtaposed with the seriousness and vulnerability of the human condition. This spurred Michigan on in their subsequent games to play with a reckless abandon. If you saw it, they just played in ways they never played this year, right? I'm not a Michigan fan, so it's hard for me to admit this. Or freedom, for they had literally faced their non-necessity. They almost died. They're done. Nothing. This close call allowed them to detach playing basketball from matters of ultimate concern. Consequently, when stepping onto the temporary sphere of the basketball court, apart from real life, it was clearly the non-seriousness of play with its joy and freedom that showed them in a very real way why the human life is worth living. To make sure they did not forget this lesson, and this is what this picture is about, Coach Bayline ambushed his team with a squirt gun in the locker room after they had just defeated, University of Louisville, to advance to the Sweet 16. I got to have a little prophetic voice in here, right? Contextualized. Doing something as inane, this is silly, this just seems stupid, absurd, right? As drenching your players with water after they just won a major game only makes sense if it is only a game. Bayline modeled to his players, this is what coaches need to be doing as far as pedagogues, right? How to make this a festive and fun experience, remembering the non-seriousness of play and their own identity, which they just met when they almost died on that plane crash. That's incredible when you think about it. So that just shows you how sports has these signals of transcendence, right? Peter Berger writes about this. So there's signing and showing going on in sport that as the people of God, if we can begin to move in and see this as the sign of the times, right? There's going to be signs of the times to say that this is fallen and broken, but there's also a sign of the times that this is actually pointing to what is good, true, and beautiful, that we can capture this, that we can actually kind of be a trickster and ride on it for God's glory. By God's grace, we exist. So trivial expressions of who we are as absurd and playful activities like sports do not need to carry the unbearable weight of eternity in order to give them meaning. In our best moments of play, we say yes to God by accepting and receiving who we are on the most fundamental level as creatures freely loved into existence by God. And our yes to God should equally issue in embracing yes to others, not exclusion. Why? Because all creatures mutually share in this splendid triviality. For in both affirmative responses, we exclaim the marvelous truth of graced, unnecessary existence. Both of these yeses impart life to persons and practice a sport, which means that trivializing sport also serves to civilize sports. So when we put it in a proper perspective, this is educating people how we ought to see sports for one's human flourishing. So what? How might this theological significance of play function as a counterculture witness and a mode of resistance to certain adversaries to this playful stance on life and sports? Let me recommend a really good book. He's at Vanderbilt now. He came from Western Theological Seminary. His name is, I think it's Jacob. He's Dutch. Hanan. And he has this book on the playful stance. It's one of the best books as far as the spirituality and what spiritual formation of how play can actually engender in us ways of being more human. And so some of my ideas do come from him. So one of the first enemies is an outcome-based. Enemy number one. And almost done here, so it'll be time for us to open it up. Is that 3:30? Yeah, okay. I was told we go to 4, right? I'm a professor, so I take the full time. Sorry. enemy number one, outcome-based. Our Western mindset is that of a driven, utilitarian approach to life, which is dead set on cost benefits, outcomes, and consequences determine the worth and meaning of a life project like sports. Another good book you need to pick up someday, Joseph Pieper, Leisure, the Basis of Culture. And he argues that we live in an age of total work. And this book was written almost 40 years ago. Sports gets reduced to the status of means, measurable results, a means to a scholarship, fame, fortune, significance. This mentality zaps or divests both sports and its players of splendid triviality. Play, like creation, cannot be forced, nor is it merely good for some use value. And when we submit to the intrinsic worthwhileness of play, we sustain a fundament of created reality, while at the same time we ennoble and enchant sports itself. Unfortunately, many youth in sports today are under the duress of mom and dad's wishes when it comes to why they play sports. Play is often perverted by adults whose performance-based world of work encroaches on their children's unbridled joy of creative free play. You know what the burnout rate in youth sports is today? 70%. Fastest growing sports are sports that mom and dad have no clue about. Why? Because they can't get on them for it. They don't understand the game, and that allows them to be free in the game. And it's lacrosse, by the way, the fastest growing sport. Because youth feel as if their duty is to play for their parents, coaches, and schools, they fetter their children's play. These children, they're the most vulnerable population, and this is what makes me so mad and why I'm in this, is because they are enslaved and entrapped by this system, right? It fetters their play with their own workday burdens and end up replaying adult frustrations. On my more wistful days, this problem has me wonder, whatever happened to backyard games? Unsupervised by parents, unorganized by AAU, Pop Warner, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, high schools, and the NCAA, in which youth freely consented to play. Might this be a place to insert the role and place of the church so that she can offer alternative ways to think about, feel, and do sports? That is not to say that play does not have benefits, so don't misinterpret what I'm saying, but that is not its primary focus. Play resists pragmatism. Play is not good and true simply because it works. From early on, the school of life instructs and trains us that such a non-utilitarian attitude or stance toward life is impractical at best and a waste of time at worst. I'm regularly conflicted and confronted with my children. My children go to Baylor. Baylor's a pretty affluent school. And all their classmates know what they're going to be doing in the future. My kids really don't know that, and I try to remind them that's okay. This is a time of vocational discernment. This is a time for you to actually see learning as a good in and of itself. So it's not only play that's good, learning is good in and of itself. I don't have to put it to service and hijack it with all these other things. Now, that doesn't mean you don't try to go and get a good job. So don't break my dialectic in two, but just recognize the purpose. We need to get back at more the non-utilitarian approach to life. Enemy number two, and I'm going to stop with this one. I'm not going to do the third one. Zero-sum logic, only winners and losers. A playful stance on sports is more just, open, and democratic than other stances on sports and life because it locates the meaning and purpose in the truth that we and our sports are splendidly trivial as revealed in the doctrine of creation. This fact about who we are as God's creatures is true of all who play sports, regardless of their class, gender, race, sex, orientation, ability, or level of competition. The radical nature of this stance domesticates sports, for what is up for grabs is not an exclusionary outcome like winning or losing, but innumerable goods to whomsoever believes in, receives, and enters this set-apart world. That is, because play like our own creaturely status is non-purposeful, yet internally meaningful, then when we play, we relish and celebrate all the goods internal to our sporting experience, such as freedom, joy, pleasure, the challenge of the test, artificial obstacles, pursuit of excellence, community, learning, and the list goes on. All these goods plentifully exist in our sports, which universally call out to all to participate in these playful contests. And if there are multiple goods to be shared and enjoyed with this stance of play, then the authority of the zero-sum winner-take-all stance is relativized, if not undermined. One philosopher points out that the overcharged ethos of winning that monopolizes contemporary sports, as notably expressed in cliches like winning isn't everything, it's the only thing, is absurd. That means to reduce the multiplicity of desires in sports to the hegemonic pursuit of victory is to ignore many of the elements that make sports worthwhile. Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all contestants are winners. I don't believe in that mantra. For the scoreboard would contradict such a claim. But what I'm saying is that whether we actually win or lose, there are enough goods to still go around so that all participants can mutually delight and enjoy the rewards which permeate in and through our splendidly trivial games. I believe it is this logic which has us come back to our games on a repeated basis, for we know and are attracted to the fact that sports should be valued primarily for its own sake, like art, music, poetry, literature, hearing the sounds of morning, feeling the touch of a lover, and staring at sunsets.